Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The devastation in Syria continues to receive widespread media attention, so why isn't Yemen receiving any attention? As today's guest, journalist Andrew Coburn, reports in Harper's Magazine, the United States is aiding and abetting the Saudi Arabian slaughter in Yemen. Over the course of the Obama administration, Coburn reports that weapon sales to Saudi Arabia has topped $111 billion, and those very weapons are being used to bomb civilians and infrastructures in Yemen. As of June, the World Health Organization reported nearly 6,500 dead Yemenis, including children, and more than 31,400 injured. Joining us to discuss coverage is Andrew Coburn, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. His latest piece is about the Saudi war on Yemen, which has full support of the United States. Andrew is author of Kill Chain: The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Today, we are also discussing a recent New York Times investigation about how think tanks amplify corporate America's influence. Eric Lipton and Brooke Williams report that as Lennar Corporation, one of the nation's largest home builders, pushed ahead with an $8 billion plan to revitalize a barren swath of San Francisco, it found a trusted voice to vouch for its work, the Brookings Institution, the most prestigious think tank in the world. Joining us to talk about this is Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, who is founder and editor of 48 Hills, an online nonprofit San Francisco progressive source for local news and culture. And Tim joins us in studio. Hi, Tim. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, happy to be here.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting really good journalism this week. So Tim, let's start with you. What caught your eye this week?
Well, what caught my eye actually was an LA Times story that talked about a new report that's been done on what happened when Berkeley passed a soda tax. And the reason this caught my eye is yesterday I got this mailer in the mail that says, if this grocery tax passes, any item in the store could go up in price. Now, they're calling it a grocery. It's not a grocery tax. It's a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. It has a line in here that says, the same tax was passed in Berkeley, and soda prices didn't actually go up, but grocery prices did. Well, the LA Times reports on the study that shows that actually that is not true, but what did happen is that youth consumption of soda, of sugar-sweetened beverages, went down by over 20% after Berkeley passed the soda tax. Now, this, of course, is one of the things that we want. This is why we're not passing in San Francisco. The idea of the soda tax is not to bring in revenue for the city. It's to discourage young people from consuming something that is directly linked to an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. So I was glad to see that the LA Times, just as this flyer hit all of our mailboxes, the LA Times showed that, in fact, that is not true.
Okay, because we really need the truth committee out there this time around, because we did a show yesterday about the 25 measures that we're going to be voting on in San Francisco.
And so many people are going to be so confused, and they're going to get this because, of course, if you look at the fine print, it says major funding by the American Beverage Association. That's who's paying for this.
Right.
And I've already gotten two of these, and the election's still 75 days away. So we are going to be flooded with misinformation about ballot measures. And that's why it's really important for journalists to go out there and say, wait a minute, what's the reality here?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up. I also wanted to bring up KQED had a piece that showed the measure here in San Francisco calls for the creation of a 16-person advisory panel to advise the Board of Supervisors about funding programs to reduce the consumption of these beverages. Oakland and Albany voters will also consider a soda tax this fall. And we will continue to cover these very important local measures on Your Call, and we'll also cover it on the special edition of Your Call, Thursdays 11 to noon. So kudos to the LA Times for telling us what this soda tax would actually do in San Francisco. Thanks for that, Tim. What about you, Andrew? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there was a whole number of pieces. It's been very hard to choose, but I'd later like to draw attention to a piece that ran in The Nation. Is called Is Angela Corey the Cruelest Prosecutor in America by Jessica Pishko. It draws attention to this nightmare of a prosecutor in Florida, who he has a sort of unparalleled. She was the one who actually failed to convict the killer of Trayvon Martin, but she has convicted hundreds of juveniles, sent many people to death row. She's, you know, famed. Or the piece lays out a very clear case of why she is a sort of serial prosecutorial abuser. And I think, you know, it's something important to remember that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about criminal justice reform, and which is, you know, focused particularly on incarceration rates and, you know, the unfairness of people convicted for nonviolent drug crimes serving their time. But, I mean, the real sort of crux of the system are these incredibly powerful prosecutorial officials. So I was really pleased to see that.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. And what is she doing right now? Do we know? I mean,
Still putting people away. And so there's no sign of stopping.
Hmm. Well, we will link to both of those stories at yourcallradio.org. That's Andrew Coburn, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. And we're joined by Tim Redmond, founder and editor of 48 Hills. Andrew, let's dive in and talk about your recent piece, which was just so devastating. I mean, you have a very lengthy story in Harper's Magazine about the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, and we have a link to it. I really hope you all can take the time to read this, because you lay out so much information. First off, and we're going to go into the details, but Andrew, Syria is getting a lot of media attention. Why don't you think what's happening in Yemen is getting much media attention?
Well, I thought a lot about this. It's partly because I think Syria is like a superpower war. It's, you know, it's us versus the Russians, and it's something in which the sort of administration is focused. Because I'm sorry to say, I think the press tends to take its line from the administration, and therefore that, you know, the this is considered a huge issue. It's a issue in the campaign. The White House has been very involved. We almost bombed Syria, and therefore, you know, that is front and center. And to a certain extent, and I know, you know, I'm not going to make any apologies for President Assad, but it's to a certain extent a neocon war. That's a war that follows on the train of the color revolutions. You know, we were all in favor of the Arab Spring, and originally the Syrian war started as a manifestation of that. So I think, you know, that gets all the attention. On the other hand, Yemen, it's a faraway country of which we know little, or to quote Neville Chamberlain, and it has been off the radar. I think it's just, as you can tell, I think it's just shocking that it has been. It's mm-hmm. hard to get to. You know, there's no sort of semi-friendly border you can hop over from. All those reasons combined to make it the almost forgotten war. I will say that's changing a little now. I think when the Saudis bombed the Médecins Sans Frontières hospital again. Well, I mean, I think it's they've been doing it all the way along, but this one finally got attention. At the same time, they hit a school and killed 19 people, including a number of children under eight, who the Saudis then said were child soldiers in training. It finally got people's attention. I think it's now just caused the administration just enough embarrassment that Secretary Kerry took time to go to Riyadh and, you know, sort of announce some peace proposals, which actually, I hate to say anything good about John Kerry, but actually have some merit. So it may be changing, but as you said, you know, this horrible war has been going on for 18 months. They've been carpet bombing what was already an incredibly poor country. And up till very recently, no one's paid much attention.
Tim, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, the United States is directly involved in this. As Andrew said, the Saudis are bombing Yemen. It's an 18-month bombing campaign, 6,500 dead. The infrastructure in many parts of the country has been decimated. And over the course of the Obama administration, weapon sales to Saudi Arabia have topped $111 billion. The U.S. is directly involved. involved. So why isn't this getting more attention?
The U.S. is directly involved, and the U.S. has been selling sophisticated weapons to Saudi Arabia for a very long time and arming Saudi Arabia. And now they're using those. I think Andrew's right when he says that, you know, Yemen is a faraway place. It's not commonly in the news in the United States. We were talking before. I said, do you know anyone who's ever been to Yemen? You know, a lot of us don't. And we think of it as just some corner. It has no strategic importance to the U.S. military. It's not something that's being talked about by politicians. And I think that, you know, a lot of the major news media take their cue from what's being talked about at the White House and what's being talked about on the campaign trail. And, you know, there was a time when major newspapers had a lot more bureaus in places other than the United States.
Right.
When we had reporters all over the world, and it wasn't just the Associated Press sending one stringer to someplace, we actually had correspondents all over. And those days are rapidly disappearing. U.S. news media are cutting back on foreign correspondents, and there's parts of the world where there really aren't any reporters. And, you know, who has a bureau in Yemen? Right? Does the New York Times have a bureau in Yemen? Does the LA Times have a bureau? Does ABC News? They don't. And so there's parts of the world where horrible atrocities go on where there's just nobody there to report it.
And a lot of people rely on social media to get their news about these atrocities. Andrew, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who are Assad apologists who are not talking about Yemen. Code Pink is one of the only organizations that has really been consistent and is talking about Yemen.
That's right, and Medea Benjamin, God bless her, she's shown up at Saudi events and made a protest and been hauled away. It's true. I mean, there's been excellent people in Congress. Very unfortunately, too few, but still some. Congressman Ted Lieu from Southern California, Senator Murphy from Connecticut. They've both been on about this for quite a while, just out of moral outrage. But it's, for the reasons that, we've been discussing, it just doesn't show up on the radar. And what's particularly heinous about it is that, Syria, we are covertly supplying arms to one side. But as you said, in Yemen, this war could not be happening in the way it is without us. Mm. We have supplied, the Saudis are, the whole defense infrastructure of Saudi Arabia has been sold to them by us. We have, as I describe in the piece, we have a very large, what in effect is a permanent sales team in Saudi Arabia, telling them how to fight their wars and selling them the equipment to do so. When the Saudis started to run out of bombs and missiles last year, we rushed them more. We quickly sold them another $1 billion worth, actually, rather more than that. Recently, they said they were running out of tanks because they'd lost so many in the war. So we've sold them another $1 billion worth again. This is our war. We are at war, and no one up till very recently has seemed to care.
And not only are we at war, we have killed 6,000 people. I mean, these are human beings. These are human lives. You think of places in the world where, five people die and it's a huge story. 6,000 people are dead in Yemen. And, this ought to be an outrage everywhere. But because of the fact that I think the media isn't paying much attention to Yemen, it's just gone up. The United States is involved in killing 6,000 people, many of them, as Andrew said, children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would just beg to differ on one thing. It's almost certainly much more than that, because those figures are derived from reports from hospitals, but, at least half the hospitals have been put out of action. So it's a very partial count. I hate to make that correction, but I talk to a lot of people who are responsible for those statistics, and they admitted that really don't have any idea. Those are just the figures they can get hold of.
So, Andrew, because this is not getting much attention, I learned so much from your piece in Harper's. Let's step back a little bit and talk about what's happening. So Yemen is bordered by Saudi Arabia, Oman, and the Red Sea. The population is 24 million people. You report that it ranks the poorest, one of the poorest countries in the world. It's 154 out of 187 nations. One in every five Yemenis go hungry. Almost one in three is unemployed. Every year, 40,000 children die before their fifth birthday. So just to give some people some information about Yemen, talk a little bit about what you found about why Saudi Arabia decided to unleash this bombing campaign in March of last year.
Certainly, I should just say quickly, that was those figures you just read out were before the war, so
wow.
They're all worse now. But the why they did it was, it basically goes back to Saudi paranoia about two things. About Yemen, for a start, because, you know, there's almost as many people in Yemen as there are in Saudi Arabia, so they've always felt slightly threatened by Yemen. And also, Yemenis, you know, they're unlike the Saudis, it's Saudi Arabia, which is basically a sort of raunchier slave economy, where Yemenis work hard, they're diligent, they had a not bad education system, even though... anyway, so they were always paranoid, and particularly paranoid, on top of that, by Shia Islam, as represented by the Iranians. So, without going into all the details, they became concerned quite some years ago. They felt that there's a sect called the Zaydis, who inhabit a large part of northern Yemen, and who are an offshoot of Shia Islam. I mean, not that, you know, it's not quite accurate to call them Shia in the way of the Iranian Shia, but still, the Saudis felt that they were, you know, they were alien, they were a threat to their southern border, and implanted a jihadi madrasa in their midst. This sort of ratcheted up tensions over the years. And when sort of coupled with the Arab Spring, I'm trying to simplify this, but Yemeni politics are always very complicated. When the Arab Spring erupted, the Zaydis, or part of them, who are the Houthis, they... basically, the fallout was they took power in northern Yemen. They occupied the capital. The Saudis freaked out at this, coupled with the fact that you had this new ruler in Saudi Arabia, this young, sort of whatever he is, 30-year-old prince, the son of the king. The king has dementia. He's kind of the crown, this young prince. He decided he was going to assert himself politically and use all the sort of great toys that they'd recently bought from the Americans and go and crush the Houthis and, you know, reassert Saudi dominance. And as anyone could have told him, but obviously the Americans didn't, that wasn't going to work because these sort of bombing campaigns never do. So they started this bombing campaign, and it had the predictable effect of actually mobilizing a lot of Yemeni public opinion behind the Houthis, who have resisted successfully since then. I have to caution you, that's a simplified version.
Right. Well, and you put so much more in your piece. Now, what's also interesting, you reveal, you try to figure out why the United States is supporting this Saudi war on Yemen. You talked to people in Washington who said that this war is not necessary to national security. You write that the best answer you got came from Ted Lieu. You mentioned him earlier, a Democratic congressman from California. He's been one of the few public officials to speak out about this. And he said, quote, "Honestly, I think it's because Saudi Arabia asked."
That's right. I mean, Ted went to some lengths. He kept, you know, asking for briefings from the Pentagon and, you know, and sort of went and talked to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And I said at the end, and he was asking this question, why is this necessary to our national security? And he got all the briefings, and I said, well, what did they tell you? I mean, what conclusion do you come to at the end of all this? And he said, well, I think it's because Saudi Arabia asked, you know, just... And the point is that this is a very casual war crime. We didn't, just as we've been saying, you know, the media doesn't care and so forth. The administration didn't really care. You know, hey, they want to go bomb Yemen into the Stone Age, so fine, no problem, you know, it's not going to affect us. So no, it was all very casual. I mean, I'll give you one example. The war started on March 26th last year, in 2015. 2 weeks later, enormous stuff. And immediately the U.S. starts does helping them with refueling the the bombing missions, supplying intelligence, sending more weapon supplies. But and then 2 weeks after this has started, and they've the bombing's been going on for that long, a senior official, Antony Blinken, Deputy Secretary of State, goes to Riyadh and asks the Saudis, "Oh, by the way, why are you doing this? What are you trying to achieve? You know, it took them that long." And the Saudis said, "Well, we want to eliminate all traces of Iranian influence in Yemen," which the Americans thought probably meant they want to kill all the Houthis. So they said, "Well, isn't that sounds going a bit? You're going a bit far. How about just saying you want to reassert, legitimate government in Yemen and prevent the Houthis taking over the whole country? In that case, carry on." And that's what they've done. So, no one's given much attention. I found in talking to people in Washington, talking to people in the administration, they say, "Oh, yes, that'll talk to so-and-so, and it'll be some relatively junior official down the line who was handling the file." It wasn't on anyone's priority list, until, as I said, very recently, and just yesterday, Secretary Kerry finally showed up. But so it's just been that's what really offended me about this, or one of the things that offended me was just the casual nature. Driven, but some people were very interested, which is the Pentagon as representing the defense industry. And as I said, we have a permanent sales mission in Saudi Arabia. And arms sales have been a high priority for the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And Saudi Arabia has been the number one customer. And so they've, used this war as an opportunity to sell, they've sold, as you mentioned, $111 billion since the start of the administration, and it's just over $20 billion, $21 or $22 billion since the war actually started.
And cluster bombs are being used, right?
Yes. Particularly the region, the sort of home region of the Houthis I mentioned is just inside the Yemeni border with Saudi Arabia. And I haven't been there, but I'm told by people, human rights researchers and others who've been there, that that whole region has been carpeted with cluster bombs. And they've even used cluster bombs even in the capital, the capital, Sana'a. Very rarely have you seen cases or heard of cases where cluster bombs were actually being dropped in cities. But they've actually done that. Now, that did actually cause a little bit of upset in Congress. Congressman Liu and Congressman Conyers and various introduced a resolution to ban U.S. cluster bomb sales to Saudi Arabia, and it almost passed, and it only didn't pass because a number of Democrats shamefully voted to not ban it.
Alexander, this is really, really important, Andrew. You mentioned just a couple politicians. Where are the rest of them? I mean, where are, the liberals' favorite senators, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, on these issues?
Not a mention. I mean, this issue, Yemen, I searched, I did a database search of all the Democratic, primary debates. It got the word Yemen occurred six times. In all the debates, come to think of it, Republican and Democrat, it got mentioned six times in very fleetingly. I think the Republicans said, "Oh, this was just Iranian aggression," and I can't remember what Hillary and Sanders and Clinton. I mean, it wasn't an issue. It just sort of popped up in the middle of a sentence. That was it. No one cared.
Tim.
You know who the major beneficiary of all of this is? The U.S. Military-industrial complex, the arms manufacturers. I mean, when we say the U.S. is selling bombs to Saudi Arabia and selling aircraft, it's not the United States government that's selling it. It's private defense contractors.
Right.
And the role that private defense contractors play in Congress is huge. I mean, the influence of the private defense industry in the nation's capital is overwhelming. And that, again, is one of the reasons why you're not seeing – I can tell you why. I don't know them by – I can't pick them out by name on the basis of what we're talking about here, but I can guarantee that some of the Democrats who did not vote to ban the sales are getting money from the arms manufacturers, because that's how it works.
Andrew, you do name names in your piece. 1,300 cluster bombs were sold by the Textron Corporation
yes.
at a cost of $641 million. You mention also Boeing. How can you talk about what's involved in finding this information?
They do have to register the sales. Well, with the case of Boeing, Boeing's principal, sale there has been F-15 fighter bombers. And the biggest sale came early on before the war in 2010 when they did a $30 billion sale, which was the largest single arms deal in U.S. history, I think. I know, in fact. And at the time, this was considered about a celebration. In fact, I was interested to note in the Hillary Clinton emails when this sale was going through, there was a lot of excited correspondence between Clinton and her aides, Sullivan and Huma Baden and people. And actually, when the sale was finally, officially signed, when the Saudis had signed on the dotted line, I think it was one of the senior aides wrote to Clinton saying, "A nice Christmas present."
Mm.
So, this is not something they do covertly.
In fact, Boeing celebrates it. They put out press releases.
Yes.
In fact,
Boeing, of course, has been a jolly good friend to the Clinton Foundation. But putting that aside, the Clinton team were saying, well, we better call the Boeing Corporation now and, confirm that we've got the deal has gone through. So this is and you can see why, for instance, the F-15s, that are being built for Saudi Arabia, I think employs seven. That production line in St. Louis is 7,000 people, and if you add up all the subcontracts around the country, I think it's about 40,000. So what congressman is not it seems like it must seem like a no brainer to many of them. You get the money from the. In terms of contributions, and you're popular because it's jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew, this was such a devastating piece, but so important. We definitely want to have you back to do an entire hour on Yemen and the U.S.-Saudi relationship. So thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all.
Andrew Coburn is Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. I hope you can read his piece, Acceptable Losses. There's a photo of 11-year-old Aziz, a little boy who was injured in the Saudi-led airstrike in a refugee camp. 45 people were wounded at this time. This was back in March 2015. And actually, 45 people were killed and 200 were wounded. And every American needs to see this photo. This is the United States is in full support of this U.S. war, Saudi war on Yemen. And I also want to mention that there is a thriving Yemeni community here in the Bay Area, and they're trying to help people in Yemen. And KALW News did a piece about the Yemeni community recently. We'll also link to that at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, Tim Redmond will stay with us for the rest of the hour, former editor of the SF Bay Guardian and founder of 48 Hills, and will be joined by the International Business Times' David Sirota, and we'll be talking with them about think tanks and also revelations of Hillary Clinton's emails. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up next week, we are putting shows together about the Dakota Pipeline. This is the pipeline that is being there are a number of protests across the country by indigenous groups. This was approved very quietly by the Obama administration recently. We'll talk about that next week. We're also doing shows on food waste, the California fires, and then Thursday we will continue our special Your Call by focusing on state and local elections. That's 11 to noon on Thursdays. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And yes, they will be putting out their slate later in a couple of months. We'll talk with...
There will be Bay Guardian endorsements out the last week of September before absentee ballots hit.
Great.
So, yes, people, the Bay Guardian was back this spring with endorsements and will be back this fall.
Great. We will look for that, and we'll have you on to talk about that.
Thanks.
Tim is also founder of 48 Hills, an online nonprofit, progressive source for local news and culture. And now I would like to welcome David Sirota to the show. David is an award-winning journalist and senior editor for investigations at the International Business Times. He joins us from Denver. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back on.
Great to have you. So you heard the end of our interview with Andrew Coburn about the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen. We were talking about weapon sales. You have been doing so much reporting on the things that we're learning from Secretary Clinton's emails. This has been getting a lot of attention in the media. What have you learned about the Saudis and the Qataris donating tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation, and what did they get in return?
Well, look, we know that major foreign governments have given large sums of money to the Clinton Foundation, tens of millions of dollars, as you allude to. A year ago, we did a series looking at one of the areas where the Secretary of State has the most power, little known outside of Washington, but the Secretary of State is statutorily, under federal law, the chief regulator of arms exports to other countries. On the website of the State Department, it says openly that it manages all government-to-government transfers of military hardware. It does work with the Pentagon on government-to-government sales, but there's also a huge segment of arms sales that go directly from commercial companies to foreign governments, which the State Department has to license and which the State Department is also in control of. So we looked at what happened for Clinton donors, Clinton Foundation donors, when she was Secretary of State. And a large number of foreign governments that had given to the Clinton Foundation saw record increases in arms export authorizations from the Hillary Clinton-led State Department. And what we have learned recently from the new email releases was something that related to that. There was one of the emails that came out was an email about from a foundation official asking the Secretary of State's office for a meeting between the Crown Prince of Bahrain, who was the second in command of that country's military. And in the email, the foundation official says that the Crown Prince had actually been rebuffed through regular diplomatic channels. And the foundation then says to the State Department official, Clinton's aide, he's a good friend of ours, talking about the Crown Prince of Bahrain. Crown Prince of Bahrain had been a major Clinton Foundation donor. And subsequently, the meeting happened. Now, if you put it in the context, I mean, there's one issue that people have focused on and said, you know, why is the Clinton Foundation brokering a meeting between one of its donors and the Secretary of State? That would seem to contrast with the arrangements, the rules that were supposed to be set up, where there was supposed to be a firewall between the State Department and the Foundation. But if you put it into a deeper context of the timeline of things, I mean, this was when one way to look at it is that Hillary Clinton, the Foundation, brokered a meeting for its Bahraini military donor with Hillary Clinton. And subsequently, of course, Bahrain saw a 187% increase in U.S. arms export authorizations from the Clinton-led State Department. Controversial, by the way, because Bahrain was accused by human rights groups of violently crushing the Arab Spring protests. In fact, at one point, a little later on, and during Clinton's term, Democrats on Capitol Hill said they were objecting to certain arms deals with Bahrain that had been approved by Clinton, by the Clinton-led State Department. Now, do we have a piece of paper that says that that the Bahraini crown prince gave money in order to get arms export authorizations from the Clinton-led State Department? No, we don't. But what we do have is a pattern here, and this is only one example, but a pattern here of Clinton Foundation donors benefiting from State Department policy, Clinton Foundation donors having business with Hillary Clinton's State Department. And the important way to think about this, I think, is that we used to have a standard in this country, and Justice John Paul Stevens talked about this in some of the rulings around the Citizens United case. We used to have a standard in this country where we generally thought that the appearance of or the potential for a conflict of interest was enough to expect politicians, lawmakers to avoid those appearances and those potentials, because the assumption was that if the potential exists, it can be operationalized in secret in myriad ways, in ways that nobody can really track, and that in order to prevent that, there was a basic presumption that politicians should avoid the appearance of or potential for a conflict of interest. Clearly, there was the potential for a conflict of interest. When business interests and foreign governments have business with a public agency, and those business interests and foreign governments are putting money into the public official's private foundation, clearly that presents a potential for a conflict of interest. I mean, that foundation is soliciting those donations. So imagine, use that example, if a foundation is asking a foreign government for X or Y amount of money at the same time that the person linked to the foundation is charged with impartially regulating that foreign government in terms of arms sales or anything else, that creates a potential conflict of interest. Do we know if it was operationalized? No, we don't. We do not know that, and I think arguably we cannot know that. You can't really know that. Even if you had subpoena power, it would be hard to know that because of the way we know how politics operates. I mean, it's very rare that there's – I mean, politicians are smart, right? I mean, they don't usually put any of this stuff down in writing.
Tim, just quickly on this, what are your thoughts about how this is being reported in this very partisan environment that we're in these days? Because The Intercept's Lee Fong, who's been on the show many times, has a piece about how Democratic pundits are downplaying the ethical issues raised by the foundation. I mean, that's not surprising at all. But you've got some progressive journalists, Vox Matthew Iglesias, saying that journalists can't come up with anything. They're not coming up with anything more scandalous than the revelations that maybe billionaire philanthropists have an easier time getting the State Department to look into their visa problems. But the Washington Post found that 2 months after Clinton encouraged the Russian government to approve an almost $4 billion deal with Boeing, the company announced a $900,000 donation to the Clinton Foundation. I mean, David Sirota has been following this very closely and has so many examples like this.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on. I think that journalists covering the Clintons and covering Washington in general have become so used to these what would seem to be astonishing conflicts that people are almost starting to say, well, gee, that's just the way it works. Right. Because, I mean, it's the same way. You know, how much money did Boeing give to members of Congress who then shortly afterwards declined to intervene when Boeing was selling weapons to Saudi Arabia to murder people in Yemen, right? And I think there's this, oh, well, that's just the way it works. I mean, it is pretty astonishing that the State Department wasn't going to talk to Bahrain until someone from the Clinton administration, from the Clinton Foundation, intervened and set up that meeting. That's pretty dramatic. And I think that's part of what's going on. The other thing I think that's part of what's going on is I think the journalistic community is terrified of Donald Trump. And I think that a lot of people are out there saying, well, you know, Trump is so awful that anything Hillary Clinton does pales in comparison to how awful Donald Trump is. So we give a pass to somebody who's done some pretty slimy, sleazy stuff, it appears, because we're so worried about the alternative. We're worried that if we bring down Hillary Clinton and show that she's not fit to be president because of the conflicts of interest, oh my God, what are we going to get? We're going to get this guy who's so much worse. And I do think that affects journalists. You know, the New York Times claims we're all objective, but that's not the case. All these reporters have personal feelings, and they're all terrified of Trump. So I do think that plays a role in the way the Hillary Clinton campaign, the emails, the State Department, the arms sales is being covered.
Hmm. David, what are your thoughts?
I definitely agree with that. I mean, it's a very well-stated point that there is this binary attitude of if you do reporting on Clinton's, it must mean you're trying to help, or even if you're not trying to, you're effectively helping Donald Trump, and therefore you shouldn't do that. I've gotten a lot of blowback that way. And look, my view is different. My view is that the more information that comes out about both of these candidates, the more informed the electorate's going to be. And we basically have a system where we're supposed to trust that democracy will bring us the best results. And the role of the press in that is to pursue these stories without fear or favor for a particular electoral outcome, which, by the way, can't be predicted. I don't subscribe to the idea that any accountability journalism done on Hillary Clinton automatically helps Donald Trump. I think you could also make an argument that accountability journalism on Hillary Clinton now helps the electorate understand, if she is president, what the electorate should be watching out for, what the electorate should expect from a culture of a Clinton administration. I think that's really important. And I think that has, frankly, been lost here. I reject the idea that doing journalism on Hillary Clinton, accountability journalism, is a way or designed to help Donald Trump. I think that's an odious attack. It's frankly a politically motivated attack. I mean, basically what you often get with these stories is fact A, fact B, fact C, fact D, fact E, all irrefutable facts, and the ultimate answer from people who don't like it is, well, Donald Trump. And that's the answer to try to cut off the conversation. Mm-hmm. And as a journalist, I find that fairly detestable because it's our job to surface these facts, again, without fear or favor.
I also think, you know, the other trend that's going on is there have been so many instances in the past when the Republicans have gone after the Clintons for, you know, starting with the impeachment proceedings, for what are really ridiculous reasons. And I think that there's also this, a lot of reporters feel like, oh my God, it's happening again. You know, Hillary Clinton can't do anything right. She's the first woman who's running for president, and they keep going after her. And that is not entirely wrong. I mean, you go back in history, and I'm not defending Bill Clinton's presidency. He did a lot of really awful stuff, but he also got attacked, and then Hillary Clinton got investigated, and there's been subpoenas and all this stuff over really minor things. So I do think that that's also causing journalists to have to second guess. But, you know, at a certain point...
Can I just add to that? Because I agree, and I would also say from the audience perspective, which is that really, you're absolutely right, but I think from the audience perspective, sometimes it's hard to hear the signal through the noise, that there's been a lot of noise around the Clintons. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of scandals, a lot of frivolous scandals, scandals that have been trumped up about the Clintons. And so it's hard for the audience to potentially discern what is something that is valid and credible versus something that's garbage. And I think the Clinton campaign and its defenders in the press have effectively operationalized that as a political weapon, basically saying, oh, well, anything that comes at the Clintons must be a trumped-up fake scandal because we've seen trumped-up fake scandals in the past. So they've actually boomeranged that situation to their political advantage, and I think it makes it, frankly, difficult for journalists who are doing serious, impartial reporting on the Clintons to have the facts they surface be treated as credibly as they deserve to be because of this dynamic.
We have an email from Bill who says, does anyone question the mission of the Clinton Foundation? Does its role as a charity mitigate its apparently shady methods of obtaining donations?
I mean, my view is this, is that, yeah, you can nitpick some of the Clinton Foundation programs, but let's, for argument's sake, say the Clinton Foundation does 100% good works. Let's just for argument's sake. And it certainly does do a lot of good work. First and foremost, the Clintons get something out of that. They get a political platform. They get a flying around the globe for all sorts of reasons that we know are beneficial to politicians and people in public life. And Bill Clinton, who gives speeches to, you know, paid speeches to companies. I mean, we know there are all these benefits that come with that. That doesn't mean that the foundation is doing bad things, but we know that it's not that there's no benefit to the Clintons from the Clinton Foundation. But I would flip it around and say this, which is, let's go to the donor aspect. These are sophisticated donors. The Saudi government is a sophisticated political donor. Corporations are sophisticated political donors. I haven't heard anyone argue that Middle Eastern dictators who are accused of committing human rights violations are giving money to the Clinton Foundation because they want to help poor children. I have not heard anybody make that argument. So you have to then ask, well, why are they giving, and not just giving once, but giving repeatedly, because they're not going to just be throwing their money away. So I think there is a question about, did they think they were getting access? Did they think they were getting something for that money? And I think that's a really important question, because they're not stupid. And I want to add one thing. You know, I've heard some folks say, well, you know, maybe they're giving just to burnish their image, you know, to be affiliated with the Clinton name. And let's use that example when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Well, arguably, that is a public good, to allow a foreign government that the Secretary of State is dealing with in a public policy way, allowing a foreign government to give money to a foundation to brand themselves as affiliated with that Secretary of State, even if that Secretary of State's office or agency is issuing, let's say, reports about how bad they are on human rights. I mean, there is something questionable about that. And I go back to the idea of why we used to have a paradigm in this country where the optics and the appearance of and the potential for a conflict of interest actually mattered. It matters precisely because of that.
David Sirota is senior editor for investigations at the International Business Times, and Tim Redmond is founder and editor of 48 Hills. We have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about, speaking of conflicts of interest, this New York Times investigation about how think tanks amplify corporate America's influence. The lead by Eric Lipton and Brooke Williams says that as Lennar Corporation, one of the nation's largest home builders, pushed ahead with an $8 billion plan to revitalize a barren swath of San Francisco, it found a trusted voice to vouch for its work, the Brookings Institution, the most prestigious think tank in the world. In July 2010, Bruce Katz, a Brookings VP, wrote to Lennar, quote, "This can become a productive, mutually beneficial relationship," end quote. The New York Times reports the ultimate benefit for Brookings was $400,000 in donations from Lennar's different divisions.
You know, this is another example of what we've been talking about all show, which is this corrupting influence of money and politics. In this particular case, corrupting influence of money in local politics in, first of all, it's not a barren swath of San Francisco. That's insulting to all of the people who live in Bayview Hunters Point.
Thank you.
And let's just get that out first. The New York Times obviously hasn't spent much time there. There are no barren swaths of San Francisco. But Lennar has this huge redevelopment project that they're doing that, by the way, was quite controversial at the time. And there were people who opposed it. And there was an effort to do a ballot initiative against it. And there were a lot of people living in Bayview Hunters Point who did not think that this was a good idea, who thought that Lennar was getting too much money for building too little affordable housing and too few community benefits, that this was not a good thing. But we didn't know, as reporters, I did not know, for example, that someone like the Brookings Institution was getting money from Lennar. There is no disclosure here until the New York Times got this internal information, which is not made public on a regular basis from these think tanks. You assume, as a reporter, you get a report from one of these think tanks that's, you know, says, oh, well, this kind of development is good for here, or this is what's going on here. Or somebody like the vice president of Lennar, Kofi Bonner, who's overseeing this project, is appointed a Brookings fellow. You think, well, that might have something to do with his involvement in urban planning. And the idea that the Washington think tanks are consistently bought off by corporations whose work they then turn around and praise is dangerous, because for so long, reporters have looked at these organizations, these things, as impartial, as, you know, as believable, as credible, as people who do public policy research for the benefit of the public. And I think some of them, I think there are many institutions that still do that, and for whom that's true. But I think we're getting to the point now where it's going to be necessary, and where it's important for all of these institutions that are out there trying to influence public policy to reveal their list of their donors.
And it's important because the media go to these think tanks on a regular basis. They are easy to get. They speak very well, and they're always available.
That's right.
So it's always the responsibility of reporters, if they bring on these think tanks, to say they're funded by, and they should also ask about their client base,
right,
which they hardly ever do.
Which they hardly ever do, because you wouldn't think that if you're calling an institution in Washington, D.C. that has expertise in urban development and planning, well, you're going to get an expert who, as you say, they have someone who answers the phone when you call or answers your email. They have an expert who's happy to talk, who's happy to give you quotes. They do reports. They publish detailed policy reports. And how often do you then say, who paid for this?
David, in 2014, you discovered a link between a $500,000 education grant to the Brookings Institution from anti-pension billionaire John Arnold. And this was a pro-reform report written by Brookings, backed by Arnold. We don't have much time, about a minute left, but how do you think the media should deal with think tanks from here on out?
Well, I mean, it's just to echo the point, which is that the media needs to not present these think tanks as necessarily impartial. I mean, even if it's a left-leaning or right-leaning, you can add that in. I mean, I found the New York Times piece to be great. It's a great addition to many years of reporting on this. The funny thing is, of course, the media has played a role in this stealth form of influence. I mean, the New York Times 2 days before that story had a piece on its op-ed page from a pro-Clinton supporter who had been in the CIA formerly, not disclosing his ties to the entire Clinton machine. So I hope that story makes people on op-ed pages and the like reevaluate on a disclosure level how the media has played an active role in that stealth machine of influence.
Well, we have that New York Times piece at yourcallradio.org. I hope you can check it out. David Sirota is senior editor for investigations at the International Business Times. We also have his pieces on the Clinton emails at yourcallradio.org. And Tim Redmond is founder of 48 Hills, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. We'll have Tim back to talk about the slate in November. David and Tim, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, we'll mark Rose Aguilar's 10th anniversary of hosting Your Call by opening up the lines. We would love to hear about your favorite Your Call episodes and what you want to hear going forward. How has Your Call motivated you to engage with your community and the world? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
There's a privately run prison system built just for immigrants, where cost cutting is cutting into medical care.
Basically, what you have in essence is people that are undertrained doing jobs that they shouldn't be doing.
Turning emergencies into disasters.
The prisoner was right. They should have called 911.
On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
That'll be Monday morning at 11 a.m. right after Your Call here on KALW. If you're a Bay Area voter and you've got a record, we have a record number of initiatives and candidates to vote on in November. And you know how important it is to stay informed. So as KALW reports on the election, we're asking for your help. We'd like to have you tell us what you think we should be keeping our eyes on and why. Go to KALW.org and click on the box that says Help Us Report on the 2016 Elections. It's easy, and it will make a difference for all of us here in the Bay Area. It's 11 o'clock. Honest it is.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, they say the customer is always right. But what lengths do you really have to go to when you're starting a business?
I've been a bodyguard for a bride who fired her maid of honor the week before the wedding. I've had to take off my strapless bra and give it to a mother of the bride who forgot hers at home. And one of the things I do consistently at weddings is help brides pee in their wedding dress.
And we all want to make the world a better place, but it seems so daunting.
Yeah, change is very difficult. I believe change is a team sport. You can't do it alone, especially in this sector.
Jen Glantz, founder of Bridesmaid for Hire, and Dawn Lippert, founder of Energy Accelerator.